You ever walk into a museum and stop dead in your tracks? Not because the aircraft is the biggest thing in the room, not because it's the most famous name on the placard. Sometimes you stop because something about the shape in front of you just does not add up. It takes your brain a moment to sort out what you're seeing, and in that moment, you forget everything else in the building. The Stephen F. Udvar Hazy Center out near Dulles has that effect on a lot of aircraft. Walk in there, and the Space Shuttle Discovery and the Concorde are hard to miss. But if you keep walking past the nose of the Enterprise, down into the main aviation bay, and you find yourself looking at a narrow, low-slung German fighter, you might stop the way I stopped the first time I saw it. There is a propeller in front. Standard enough? And then you look toward the tail, and there's another propeller, on the same centerline, mounted just aft of the tail surfaces. That is the Dornier Du 335 Pi fail. Fail is the German word for arrow. And standing under the only surviving example in the world, you understand immediately both the name and the idea. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar, here on Radio Hangar. Today we are going to talk about one of the strangest, fastest, and most ambitious piston engine fighters ever built, and what it means that only one of them still exists. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, the year is 1943, and Germany is starting to feel the weight of a war that is going wrong in multiple directions at once. American heavy bombers are coming over from Britain in formations that fill the sky from horizon to horizon. The planners and engineers at the Reich Air Ministry are running calculations and losing sleep. The arithmetic of air defense was straightforward and terrible. The bombers cruised at around 200 miles per hour and came in high, in tight formations with overlapping fields of fire from their defensive guns. The American P-47 Thunderbolts now escorting them from English bases could do 400 miles per hour in a dive. To break through those escorts and make an effective attack on the bombers, a German interceptor needed not just raw speed, but a combination of climb rate, acceleration, and sustained level flight performance that was beyond what the existing single-engine designs could reliably deliver. The obvious engineering answer was more power. The Focke-Wulf FW-190 and the Messerschmitt 109G series were already being pushed toward higher and higher horsepower. But there is a physical ceiling to what a single propeller can absorb. Once you cross roughly 2,000 horsepower on a standard-sized propeller, you start losing efficiency. The prop tips approach compressibility. Vibration becomes a structural concern. The power you're adding is not converting cleanly into thrust. Twin-engine designs existed. The Messerschmitt 210, the Bf 110. These put two engines side by side on the wing. More power, yes, but also more drag, more weight, and the asymmetric thrust problem. If one engine quits on takeoff in a conventional twin, you have an immediate yaw emergency that kills inexperienced pilots and challenges experienced ones. Not ideal for an interceptor being flown by increasingly young and hastily trained Luftwaffe pilots in the fourth year of a grinding war. Claude Dornier had been thinking about the problem differently. What if you put both engines on the center line of the fuselage? One engine up front, turning a conventional tractor propeller, pulling the aircraft forward. The second engine mounted behind the cockpit, driving a long extension shaft that ran back through the tail structure, connecting to a pusher propeller mounted at the very rear of the aircraft. All of the power of a twin with the aerodynamic drag profile of a single. And because both engines were on the same centerline, an engine failure did not induce a yaw moment. You flew on one motor with no critical directional control problem, no sudden rolling tendency to fight on a short runway. That is the push-pull centerline thrust concept, and it was elegant in the way that ideas are elegant when they address several problems at once with a single solution. But there was a problem that nobody building conventional aircraft had ever had to solve before. That rear propeller, bailing out of a conventional fighter, is dangerous enough. You roll the aircraft, the canopy goes, and you fall clear into relatively clean air. With a pusher propeller spinning aft of the tail, there is no clean way out. Any pilot attempting a standard bailout exits the cockpit and immediately encounters a spinning disc moving faster than any car on any highway. The physics are not survivable. Dornier's engineers designed an escape system. When the pilot initiated the ejection sequence, two explosive charges fired in sequence. The first blew off the rear propeller assembly. The second blew away the upper vertical fin section. Then the seat's charge fired, kicking the pilot clear of the aircraft. They tested this system. It worked, in the sense that you could fire the charges, detach the propeller, and launch a test mass clear of the aircraft. But the idea of trusting your life to a sequence that first had to remove a tail structure before it ejected you, all at speeds approaching 500 miles per hour, required a particular kind of faith in the engineering that few pilots were entirely comfortable with. This was, in some sense, one of the earliest production ejection seats ever fitted to a combat aircraft. Before ejection seats were standard, before Martin Baker had made the concept something every fighter pilot trusted without thinking about it, the Du 335 pilot of 1944 was sitting on top of something genuinely new in every sense of the phrase. The aircraft that emerged from this design process was extraordinary. Two Daimler-Benz DB603 engines, each producing around 1,800 horsepower. Maximum speed in production testing came in close to 475 miles per hour. Climb rate that impressed evaluators accustomed to the Focke-Wulf and late Mark Messerschmitts, and handling characteristics that test pilots described as crisp, predictable, and surprisingly pleasant given the novelty of the configuration. The pilots who flew the pre-production Du 335s at Recklin, the Luftwaffe's main test facility, filed reports ranging from impressed to frankly astonished. One test pilot noted that power application in the Du 335 produced thrust rather than torque effects. That is the centerline configuration in practice. Push the throttle and the aircraft goes forward, cleanly, without trying to corkscrew away from you, the way a high-powered single will when you push it hard on a short final. The cockpit sat high in the fuselage, giving the pilot an unusually good forward view for a propeller aircraft. The landing gear was wide-tracked and conventional. Taxiing was easier than many of the hot-rod single-engine fighters the Luftwaffe was operating. On approach, the aircraft was stable and manageable. Pilots who came from the Messerschmitt 109, which had narrow gear and a tendency to embarrass you on the rollout, found the Du 335 almost relaxing to land. The Luftwaffe had a machine that could, in the right circumstances, run from an Allied escort fighter and still catch the bombers. Several variants were on the drawing boards or in prototype. The A1 was the primary single-seat day fighter, a two-seat trainer, a heavy night fighter with radar equipment, and a second cockpit positioned behind the pilot. A high-altitude interceptor with a pressurized cockpit in development. Now here is where it gets interesting, where the whole story pivots. The Dornier facility at Oberpfaffenhofen, near Munich, was the primary final assembly site for the Du 335. Allied intelligence knew about it. Allied bombers had targeted it. By the time series production was running in the autumn of 1944, the factory was working under conditions that were the opposite of everything precision manufacturing requires. Germany's aviation fuel supply had been systematically attacked. The high-octane fuel those Daimler-Benz engines required was rationed, then further rationed, then sometimes simply unavailable in the quantities needed. Test flights were conducted on blended fuels that detuned the performance the engineering specifications promised. The factory workers building these aircraft were a mix of experienced Dornier employees, conscript labor, and workers evacuated from bomb-damaged facilities elsewhere in Germany. Skilled hands were in short supply. Replacement parts took longer to arrive. Quality control, the kind that makes identical aircraft actually identical, became increasingly difficult to maintain. The result was a production run that was simultaneously impressive and heartbreaking. Approximately 37 Du 335s were completed. How many flew actual combat missions is genuinely uncertain. The final weeks of the war in Europe are documented incompletely. Records were destroyed by German forces. Others disappeared in the chaos of the collapse. Historians examining the surviving records have been debating these numbers for decades, and probably always will be. What is documented is what happened when American forces arrived. Technical intelligence teams from the United States Army Air Forces had standing orders to locate and secure German aeronautical technology. Lists of specific aircraft, engines, and components had been prepared in advance. The Du 335 was high on that list. Performance numbers that had filtered through neutral countries had generated genuine interest at Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio. At Oberpfaffenhofen, the advancing forces found Du 335s in various states, some still in shipping crates, some partially assembled and apparently abandoned mid-build, at least one that appeared ready to fly. Several aircraft were moved to Cherbourg in France and then shipped across the channel for evaluation by the Royal Air Force at Farnborough. The British test pilots who flew the Du 335 came back with reports that confirmed what the German engineers had claimed. The Royal Air Force's verdict was straightforward. This was the fastest piston engine aircraft they had evaluated, not the fastest they had heard about, the fastest they had actually flown, coming from pilots who had also evaluated the Hawker Tempest, late Mark Spitfires, and other captured German aircraft. That was not a casual statement. Other examples crossed the Atlantic to Wright Field, where Army Air Force's engineers spent the summer and autumn of 1945 disassembling, measuring, photographing, and testing them. The American evaluation confirmed everything. No unpleasant surprises. The Germans had built precisely what their performance sheets described under conditions that should have made that impossible. One of those aircraft eventually passed into the collection of what would become the National Air and Space Museum. It moved through various storage facilities and museum locations over the decades. The establishment of the Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center gave it a permanent home. The aircraft at Udvar-Hazy is the only complete Du-335 in the world. 37 built, one survives. That number stays with you when you stand under it. The scale is different from what photographs prepare you for. The fuselage is longer and narrower than you expect, built for minimum frontal area. The cockpit canopy sits high and proud, giving the aircraft a slightly hunchbacked profile from certain angles. And those two propellers, one fore and one aft, give the whole machine a symmetry that feels almost theoretical, like an engineer's proof of concept rather than a weapon of war. Original German factory markings are still visible on the aircraft, showing through subsequent coatings in the way that old paint does on something that has been around long enough. This airplane was built in Bavaria, in the final months of the war, by German workers under conditions of considerable desperation. German test pilots flew it. American intelligence officers flew it. British test pilots flew it. And now it hangs there in Northern Virginia, 20 feet above the floor, while visitors work their way toward the Concorde and occasionally stop to puzzle over the propeller in the back. That continuity, that unbroken physical chain from the factory floor at Oberpfaffenhofen to the climate-controlled bay at Udvar-Hazy, is part of what makes the Du-335 more than an engineering curiosity. Aviation people sometimes ask why nobody copied the design. If the push-pull centerline configuration was so effective, why didn't it appear in post-war fighters? The honest answer is timing. The design was genuinely effective when the question was still how to extract more performance from piston engines. By 1946, that question had been replaced by a different one. The jet engine solved the power problem without the drive shaft, without the ejection complexity, without the elaborate synchronization of two engines on a single centerline axis. The Du-335 answered the last question of the piston era at the exact moment a new era was beginning. There is a civilian footnote worth mentioning. The Cessna 337 Skymaster uses the same basic push-pull layout. Two engines on the centerline, one tractor and one pusher, specifically so that a single engine failure doesn't create the asymmetric thrust emergency that can kill pilots in conventional twins. Cessna built the 337 for general aviation pilots who wanted the safety margin of a twin without the critical engine problem. The configuration that Dornier used to build the fastest piston fighter in the world ended up on a gentle six-seat family airplane over Midwestern farmland. Aviation has a sense of humor about these things. The Du-335 sits in a particular company of machines, the kind that represent the absolute outer edge of what was possible before the next technology arrived. Aircraft that came in at the end of a long engineering conversation, answering the final questions, right before everyone moved on to a different conversation entirely. There is a gravity to those machines that their more famous contemporaries sometimes don't have. The famous aircraft tell you what their era accomplished. The final question aircraft tell you where the era was going when it ran out of time. Pull up a chair for a moment and think about that. 37 of these aircraft were built by human hands in a factory under threat, using materials that were running out, driven by a program that was always racing ahead of its own ability to deliver. The people who built them believed they were building something that might change the outcome of a war. They were not wrong about the machine. They were wrong about the time. If you find yourself near Dulles, the Udvar-Hazy Center is worth your full day. Go to the Du-335, walk around it. Look at both propellers, look at the height of that cockpit, and think about the test pilot sitting there with a drive shaft under his seat and an explosive charge between him and the seat pan, evaluating the machine in 1945, while the world was sorting itself out around him. This is what good aviation museums do. They preserve the physical record of what human beings actually built when they were trying hard enough and desperate enough and brilliant enough to do things nobody had done before. Most of the technical background in today's segment comes from the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum's own documentation and from German aviation research that has worked through the surviving Dornier records. Heinz Nawara's historical work on Luftwaffe aircraft and the technical evaluation reports in the National Archives fill in the engineering details. Find us at radiohanger.com. I'm Taildragger. Until next time.